Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today in Beijing, the United States, North Korea, and China sat down to share a very rare cup of tea. The backdrop, North Korean nuclear threats and an American doctrine of preemption fresh off the Iraqi battlefield. Tonight, On Point, the other weapons crisis, nukes, North Korea, and America fresh from war. We begin in Beijing, where it is now 7 a.m. Thursday morning, and a second round of meetings will soon be getting underway. China is hosting the talks, the first three-way meeting of the U.S., North Korean, and Chinese governments since the 1953 armistice talks that ended the Korean War. For the latest, we turn to Rob Gifford, Beijing correspondent for NPR. He joins me now from Beijing. Good morning, Rob Gifford.
Hi there. Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Rob, we know these are quiet, low-key talks so far. What has come out? Have there been statements after yesterday's meeting? What do we know?
Well, no. In fact, they're so quiet and so low-key, we haven't heard anything. And I think you know there's something strange going on when the most open participant at the talks is the Chinese government. The North Koreans, of course, are famous for their silence and the opaqueness of their political system. And the Americans, quite the opposite, have a very large media machine for dealing with the press in Washington and, of course, in every capital where they have an embassy. But they just have said absolutely nothing to us. So we are very much in the dark as to what was said yesterday or today, your time.
Rob, are there tea leaves to be read here about the location of the meetings, about who's attending from the Chinese side? What can be read in even to these quiet meetings?
I think possibly one of the main set of tea leaves to be read is on the North Korean side, because the main negotiator, a man called Lee Gun, is the North Korean. He's a former, I think, number two at the North Korean embassy in the United Nations, and he's not actually very senior. People I've spoken to here, diplomats, say it's very unlikely that any kind of deal would be cut with this particular official from North Korea, because he just doesn't have the authority. He's not even a sort of vice foreign minister. The other thing I think that is definitely important to say is about the venue. The fact that they're taking place in Beijing is very significant, and it marks a very big change in China's involvement in the region. China is obsessed with non-interference in the affairs of other countries. It goes on and on about this, especially when talking to the United States. Now it has stepped up to the plate, and I think its concern about regional instability, its concern that things were really getting to a point, a possible crisis point, has overridden those concerns about interfering in what North Korea is up to. And they have actually, to some extent, brokered this deal. The other thing, of course, that has brokered the deal is North Koreans watching the Iraqi war on their television sets and getting quite frightened. I think those two things is what pushed the North Koreans into discussion.
Of course, not so much really a deal yet as an agreement or deal simply to meet. But it's an interesting point you raise, Rob, about how this is being presented in China. Of course, North Korea wanted only a two-way meeting with the U.S. The United States wanted only a multilateral meeting. Is China presenting itself as a party to three-way talks, or is it saying we're just hosting North Korea and the United States in its own press?
I think it's very much saying, well, it's probably saying both, actually, but it is certainly saying the former. I think the Chinese want to make it very clear that they are.
Looks like we've lost Rob Gifford there.
I'm still here. I just heard.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rob. You just cut out on me for a second.
Yeah, I heard a little glitch on the line. I'm sorry. I don't know what that was. Maybe they don't like what I'm telling you. It happens occasionally. I was just saying that the Chinese want to be a player. They want to say to their people that they're a player, and they certainly want to show the Americans that they're a player, because they don't feel they get enough respect from the United States. So if they're able to show that they can create these kinds kind of talks. They can create talks that lead to some kind of resolution. I think they're going to be very pleased, and I think they're in a very much a win-win situation here. If the talks fail, well, you know, they tried, and nobody in Washington can criticize them, as they have done in the past, for not doing enough. If the talks lead to further talks and lead to some kind of resolution, well, China looks golden, because they're the ones who, to a large degree, have brokered it.
And finally, Rob, of course, there are many agendas on the table here. North Korea is threatening to develop nuclear weapons. There's talk in Washington about regime change, though it's not put forward as official policy. What is Beijing's ideal outcome for this standoff?
Well, Beijing is in a very difficult situation. I'm not sure there's really an ideal scenario, and that's the problem. Every scenario is difficult for China. What it would want, ideally, is for North Korea to remain a country, to stay how it is, but to reform gradually and to open up, just as China did 25 years ago after the death of Mao. There are two other scenarios that it desperately wants to avoid. One is a nuclearized North Korea, because that would push Japan probably to rearm and could start an arms race in Northeast Asia. And the other is a collapsed North Korea, which if Kim Jong-il were overthrown, or a U.S. military strike that would unify the Korean Peninsula under U.S.-South Korean alliance, and then they will see hundreds of thousands of refugees coming over the border into China, and it would cause a very, very big problem for the Chinese to sort of mop up the problems from that. So the main problem is, though, that I think we've reached the point, everybody feels, where the status quo just is not, it can't go on like this. And so China's preferred option of simply going on like this, I think, is not particularly viable, certainly not in the long term, beyond like a year or two.
High stakes for everyone. Rob Gifford, thanks for joining us so early in the morning there.
Thanks very much.
Rob Gifford is NPR's Beijing correspondent. He spoke with me from Beijing. When Saddam Hussein refused to disarm, the United States went to war. Now Washington's attentions turn to North Korea. Kim Jong-il appears to be sticking to his guns. So does George Bush. Pyongyang wants assurances that the U.S. won't attack it, among other things. Washington wants a verifiable end to North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Neither side knows right now how far the other is prepared to go in pursuit of its goals. Should Washington be ratcheting the pressure on North Korea down or up? And how far could all this go? Is surrender the only way off the axis of evil? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Ashton Carter, professor of science and international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a longtime Korea watcher from 1993 to 1996. He served as assistant secretary of defense in the Clinton administration. In 1998, he conducted the North Korea policy review for President Clinton with Secretary of Defense William Perry. Good evening and welcome, Ashton Carter.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. So, peer out toward Beijing with us and this very unusual sit-down of China, North Korea, and the United States. We talked some months ago about the crisis in North Korea, where it could go. Everybody agrees that the stakes are very high here. North Korea could soon be producing multiple nuclear warheads per month, per year. There, as we know, are hot heads in the United States, in Washington, who would like to push very hard right now. I guess maybe the place to jump in is, how has the war in Iraq and its apparent outcome affected the chemistry around this standoff?
Well, we're speculating if we talk about North Korea's reactions, because it's anybody's guess what North Korea is thinking. On the one hand, as Rob Gifford indicated in the earlier segment, maybe North Korea concluded from Iraq that they're in real trouble and they better come to the table. It's just as plausible that they concluded the opposite, which is the only way to defend yourself against the Americans is to have nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Maybe they came to the table because the Chinese brought them to the table, and they figure they're better off at a table with the Chinese and the Americans than with the Americans alone. So all these theories are bubbling around. We don't really know, because it's very hard to read the North Koreans.
And what about on the U.S. side, in Washington? The war in Iraq presumably has been seen in some neoconservative quarters there as
as evidence that a preemption policy works, that a big stick works. Do you see that? Do you feel that working into American policy toward North Korea?
I don't think the Bush administration, has yet arrived at a strategy for dealing with North Korea. In some ways, that's understandable because they've been very busy with Iraq. There are different views in the administration. I think that most of those views are at this point half formed. And not resolved among themselves. So there are three, broadly speaking, different approaches one could take to dealing with North Korea. The first is to try to talk them out of going nuclear. The second is to use military force to stop them from going nuclear. And the third is to let them go nuclear and hope that they'll collapse, maybe even hasten their collapse.
Maybe even hasten, i.e. actively hasten, that Washington would work to actively hasten the collapse.
That's right. Now, that's an idea that has been going around as long as I've been associated with the North Koreans, but they have amazing staying power. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't want to talk to them and you're going to let them go nuclear, then the issue for anybody who advocates that is what makes you think you're really going to bring down the North Korean regime anytime soon or that you're going to bring them down before they do lasting damage by creating plutonium that once it's created might get out of North Korea. You don't know what
could end up anywhere. They certainly have exported missiles all over the world. Ash Carter, what do you make of the memo apparently from Donald Rumsfeld leaked just as these meetings were getting underway that appeared to call for regime change, not by military intervention, but by a concerted effort of China and the United States to encourage the collapse of the regime in Pyongyang? Timing very interesting, just as talks were getting underway. Legitimate leak? And B, is this the Pentagon once again crossing Cole and Powell's more moderate State Department line and saying, we're going to call the tune here and it's going to be a tough tune?
Well, I think this is one more example of half-baked, if you like, thinking. And there are several theories, of which this is one. The theory propounded in this particular memo was that maybe we can get the Chinese to help us destabilize North Korea, open up their borders, let the North Koreans flee out across their border into China, flee from the government of Kim Jong-il. Well, that's an interesting theory. However, it requires that the Chinese actually wish to do that, which they adamantly do not wish to do. So it's an example of a wouldn't it be nice if kind of theory. I think that it's going to take some time for this administration to think it through and battle it out among themselves before they come to a settled strategy. And that's why Jim Kelly over there holding these talks is really on a pretty short leash.
In the meantime, how dangerous does this situation remain? I'm reading a news report here out of Tokyo today from Russia's deputy foreign minister saying that a catastrophic development of events in the U.S.-North Korean nuclear standoff was imminent and could occur within the next day. I mean, is this thing on some kind of complete tenterhooks on such a – I don't know. Is North Korea even now or the United States willing to push this to some extreme very suddenly? Could you imagine that?
I don't know that it'll be sudden, but let's be clear that the United States cannot tolerate a nuclear North Korea. And it's worth remembering the many ways in which letting North Korea go nuclear would be a disaster for our security. First of all, if North Korea gets nukes – they sell them, as you indicated earlier.
They
might
could.
Sell them.
Mm-hmm.
Second, North Korea can't last forever in its current form. So at some point it could collapse like the Soviet Union did.
And then what happens
with
to those
problem.
Nukes?
Mm-hmm. Even if the nukes just stay in the hands of the North Korean government, that might weaken deterrence on the Korean Peninsula, make war more likely, start the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Taiwans wondering whether they need to have nuclear weapons, undermine the global nonproliferation regime. So any way you look at this, this would be a huge setback. It's much bigger stakes than Iraq. So we can't let that happen.
So even if people are talking about quiet meetings in Beijing, that does not mean that we've got a quiet situation here. The Russian deputy foreign minister today said the standoff has reached an extreme stage. Who knows? I mean, Russia wasn't invited to the party. Maybe that's part of it. But he seems to be reflecting what you're saying. The stakes are very high here, and this can't be allowed, won't be allowed to go on.
Absolutely right.
We're talking tonight about the other weapons crisis, North Korea and its nuclear threat. You can join the conversation. Do you want to see Washington negotiate with North Korea or intimidate North Korea? Should Pyongyang fear it could be the next Baghdad? Would that be helpful or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the other weapons crisis, North Korea and its nuclear threat. The U.S., North Korea, and China have met in Beijing today. They'll be meeting again in just a few hours' time in the Chinese capital for the first time in 50 years that these three governments or their representatives have sat down together, the first time since the armistice that ended the Korean War. You can join the conversation tonight. Does the Bush administration want a real conversation with North Korea or just submission? Should Washington keep a military threat viable as it talks with Pyongyang? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Ashton Carter, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. We're joined now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, by Selig Harrison, Director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington. He's author of Korean Endgame. He's been a frequent visitor to North Korea. Good evening and welcome back, Selig Harrison.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Selig Harrison, you spoke with us a few months ago when this crisis was coming to a first boil. It's been boiling and simmering and boiling again ever since. How do you see the progress that's been made over these last months? Are we nearer to a solution, and how does the war in Iraq figure into the chemistry?
Well, I think we're about to boil over now. It's in a very dangerous stage, and you're a man in Beijing who said that it would take time for the Bush administration to decide on its policy. I think that you missed the point, because the urgency of the situation is growing day by day. North Korea is really poised to go ahead with a full-scale effort to develop a nuclear weapons program. As far as they're concerned, the Iraq war, coupled with the September 20th preemption doctrine of the Bush administration that we have the right to take preemptive military action against any country we think is a potential threat, they're convinced that they need nuclear weapons now. And the burden is really on us, so far as they're concerned, to convince them that they don't need to deter us with a nuclear program. So these Beijing meetings are going to be very important. I don't say that this is the last chance at these meetings in Beijing, because China's involvement would no doubt keep the process going as long as they think it's worth keeping it going. But the North Koreans are testing us. They want to see whether we're committed to this policy that we took when Secretary Kelly went to Pyongyang last October 4th and basically said that North Korea had to dismantle its nuclear program before any substantive negotiations could take place.
A real hard line.
Yeah, a real hard line. And if that's the line, then I think we're in real trouble. The North Koreans are either poised to start reprocessing their spent fuel rods into plutonium, or they have already started it, which is quite possible. It seems to me there was a big flap over the weekend about some.
They said in English that they've begun. They said in Korean that they had not begun.
Well, whether they had said that the process was over and they already had reprocessed them all, or they were about to start it, or whether they had started it but it was just getting underway. I mean, there are all kinds of, I think, rather deliberate ambiguity on their part. It's comparable to what Mr. Carter, Ash Carter, and others in the Pentagon have always called NCND, neither confirm nor deny, with respect to whether we have nuclear weapons in any part of the world. They're trying to copy that and keep us guessing. But there's no question that they've made a decision the hardliners who favor a nuclear weapons program in Pyongyang, and there are two camps on this, are much stronger now than they've ever been, particularly after Iraq. And so the fact that in Beijing, just in the last few days, we've had Marshal Jong Myung-rak, the number two man in the North Korean hierarchy, talking to the Chinese, and he may still be there for all we know, sort of hanging around for a couple of days.
In the margins.
North Korean negotiators to come and talk to. That's a symbol of the new role of the army in North Korea, which has been much stronger than it was in the days of Kim Jong-il's father.
Sally Harrison, do you interpret that to mean that it is possible, despite the low-key tone that's been put around it, that something substantial might come out of Beijing?
I think something terrible might come out of Beijing. I don't think anything substantial is likely to come out of one set of meetings.
And the terrible thing would be?
What would be good would be that it doesn't become a showdown, doesn't become a crisis, mm-hmm. and the opportunity for further talks is kept alive, that we've shown a little flexibility and given them a little hope that maybe we'll bend on this. As far as the North Koreans are concerned, they are willing to trade their nuclear program if they get a complete turnaround in the U.S. relationship. Not only do they want to be convinced that they don't need nuclear weapons for military reasons, but they want to know whether we're committed to the policy of regime change. Mm. That not only Secretary Rumsfeld in that memo that was just mentioned, but also the president has very explicitly in his interview with Bob Woodward, for his Bob Woodward's book, mm-hmm. talked about toppling Kim Jong-il, and that's really, I think, in many ways, the most important thing that we have to do. Even before this very difficult issue of working out a mutual non-aggression agreement is addressed in a way that is linked to the end of their nuclear program, even more important is laying to rest the idea that we want regime change. Until we're willing to make a statement, a formal binding commitment that we respect their sovereignty, those are the code words that they used with Secretary Kelly last October.
Right.
I don't think we're going to get anywhere. I think that it's we have to have a complete clarity with respect to a new approach toward Pyongyang.
Ash Carter, can you imagine? Put yourself at that table in Beijing. What do you think the explicit or implicit message coming from James Kelly there is? Is it, hey, we're ready to stand down on all this hostile talk and assure you of your sovereignty, assure you that there will be no regime change? Or is it, look what we just did to Baghdad. Again, stated or not, look what we just did to Baghdad. You'd better get in line or the same mighty military machine may be menacing you.
I'm afraid it's a little of both, and therefore the North Koreans are not getting a clear message. That gets back to the point I made earlier. Mm-hmm. This matter, this fundamental matter of that you began the hour with, are we prepared to let North Korea keep on keeping on mm-hmm. as this odd little thing? That's the principal question. President Bush, as Selig Harrison has indicated, has certainly used very colorful language to indicate that the answer may be no from his point of view. Mm. That is the question that they need to hear some definitive word from in Washington. And I don't think Jim Kelly's in a position to give that word because I don't think Washington has made that decision.
But I'm hearing a fundamental, what sounds to me like a different tack here in what I'm hearing from Selig Harrison and from you, Ash Carter. I know in our earlier conversations you have felt, correct me if I'm wrong, that it is important in conversations with North Korea to keep a military option on the table, or at least near the table, or you won't be taken seriously. But of course, any military option on the table will look presumably much larger in the aftermath of Iraq than it did before. Is it still useful? Is it still necessary? Or might it be driving Pyongyang to embrace all the harder the development of nuclear weapons?
Well, there are two levels of military action you can contemplate here. One is to go and attack the nuclear program at Yongbyon. Mm-hmm. That is something that I was personally involved in the planning for in 1994. We contemplated that. We could contemplate that again today. It would almost surely be successful in setting back the plutonium program in North Korea. However, the result of that attack might be that North Korea unleashes its antiquated but large army across the DMZ, and you have a war in the Korean Peninsula, which is not war in the Iraqi desert. It's an entirely different proposition because it's in the suburbs of a crowded city, Seoul.
Could leave
Seoul.
South Korea devastated and all of Northeast Asia in an uproar.
Right. However, you need to remember that if we were to launch that strike, the ball would be in North Korea's court. And we should accompany any action, if God forbid we ever have to take that action, with the word to North Korea that, listen, we are taking out Yongbyon because we feel we have to. We're not starting the big war. If you elect to attack south, that will be the end of your regime. The ball's in your court. You decide. Because we don't know how they'll decide, it's a risky course. But it's a course we need to keep on the table. They need to understand we can't tolerate a nuclear North Korea.
You're the one-time Assistant Secretary of Defense. Do you imagine, do you assume that such a plan sits somewhere in the Pentagon right now?
Oh, I think it would be a dereliction of duty if there were not such a plan in the Pentagon right now.
Sally Harrison, speak to the same issue, the military option. Where should it be in the U.S. kit bag as it talks with North Korea? A front and center? Nowhere in sight? How do you see it?
Well, I certainly don't think it's it should be in the talks. Obviously, we have an inherent we have various options that we could exercise if we think that something is happening that requires that. The point is, what will we accomplish? What's our objective? Our objective is to get rid of the North Korean nuclear program and avoid a war in the not only in the Korean Peninsula, but would spread to Japan, too. I mean, if we attack North Korea, they would go after U.S. bases in Japan before they would go to the DMZ, it seems to me. Hmm. So you'd have a regional mess and a disaster, which would it's just totally counterproductive. The point to be made, really, is that we have a North Korea here, which is in desperate economic condition, very eager to make peace with the United States. We've been missing opportunities over and over again. Last October 4th, when Kelly went to Pyongyang and confronted them with the evidence of their uranium enrichment program, and they said, look, we're willing to negotiate to prove that, they said, look, we're willing to discuss the accelerated schedule for shipping these plutonium fuel rods out of North Korea so that there wouldn't be any possibility that they'd be reprocessed into plutonium. That was supposed to happen in the very last stages of this 1994 nuclear freeze agreement that we concluded with North Korea. They offered, I've learned from people who were in that room, to discuss an accelerated schedule for shipping the fuel rods out of the country so we wouldn't be where we are now.
A significant offer. What did they want in return?
What'd you say?
What did they want in return? That's a significant offer.
That was one of the things that would be on the table in a wide-ranging negotiation that would include economic aid, that would include respect for sovereignty pledges and no-attack pledges linked to denuclearization.
So you're laying the stalemate at the feet of the Bush administration.
What'd you say?
You're laying the stalemate, the bulk of it, at the feet of the Bush administration,
well,
as I hear you.
Absolutely. There isn't any question. This has been a completely mishandled policy, one missed opportunity after another, letting the situation slide to a really dangerous point. Here we had an opportunity to get those fuel rods out of the country as part of an overall settlement. That's the one thing that could lead to North Korea having nuclear material in its hands that they could, if they got into a real confrontation with us, make available to our enemies.
But that sounds like what James Kelly wanted. It sounds like what he came for.
I'm sorry?
That sounds like the very thing that James Kelly came for.
He came as a representative of an administration paralyzed by divisions over what to do with respect to Korea. They've been paralyzed ever since they came to office, so he had no mandate to say anything except what some of the very hardline elements in the administration want him to say, which is, you guys submit to us, do what we say, click your heels, and there's nothing else to talk about.
Ash Carter, is this being bungled here, or is this a tough, clear-eyed approach by Washington?
Oh, it's not a tough, clear-eyed approach. And yes, it's true, as Sig Harrison correctly says, that the administration has not formulated a strategy, may have missed some opportunities along the way. My only point is, without taking away from that, there's plenty of blaming to go around here. The North Koreans were the ones who initiated a uranium program, enrichment program, while there was in force an agreement with us and with the rest of the world through the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty not to do so. So they put anyone advocating talking to them in a very difficult position by cheating on the last agreement they negotiated. There's blame to go around in South Korea as well. Our allies in South Korea have also been wandering and wavering in their attitudes towards North Korea and in their solidarity with us. So this whole picture is very messy.
But the blame game leaves us without a solution. Meanwhile, the nuclear threat mounts.
That's right. So I don't think we can look backward. Let's look forward. Where can we go from here to avoid the war that really would be a catastrophe?
But we also do have to recognize that the idea that you can't trust North Korea to carry out an agreement is really not proved by the past. The agreement that they signed in 1994 involved shutting down a plutonium program that could have produced 30 nuclear weapons a year. They observed that because they think we didn't observe the things that we were supposed to do under that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
When the Pakistanis came along in 1998 and said, here, we'll pay you for those missiles we're getting from you in enriched uranium technology, they agreed to it, as a hedge
mm-hmm.
against what they saw as the Clinton administration's non-fulfillment of its promise of to normalize relations, turn things around with North Korea. Now, it was a violation, but it's part of a picture in which they did observe quite well the provisions of the plutonium parts of the agreement, and they kept doing that even after they went into this secret uranium deal with the Pakistanis.
It looks like time to tie up these loose ends, or we may all be paying the piper soon. Keith is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi. I hope we don't get into military action against North Korea, but one of the arguments made against military action like that is that there could be a war on the Korean Peninsula and kill a million or more South Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point out that most Americans would rather risk the lives of a million South Koreans now, and it's only a risk, not a certainty. They'd rather risk the lives of a lot of South Koreans now than of a lot of Americans later.
So are you saying, Keith, that it's worth the risk of those South Korean lives to end a North Korean nuclear weapons program?
It could be.
I mean, don't you feel like you're playing God a bit with numbers so big and lives so many?
Unfortunately, that's the nature of international politics today with the weapons that are around.
Keith, we've got it. Let me put it to Ash Carter, because Ash Carter, I heard just a little bit of a premonition of this call in what you were saying earlier, that the Pentagon calculus may be, as horrific as it sounds, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that may at some point be a risk that the United States would be willing to take. Can you imagine us doing the surgical strike on Yongbyon that would risk North Korean retaliation that could put so many South Korean lives at risk?
That is the risk we would take in that option. Clearly, that is a very substantial risk. I don't think anybody who's been involved in planning such things in the past or now minimizes that risk. That is the risk, and as I said, it's a very sporty course.
Sporty is such a word. I'm sorry.
Your caller, dangerous course. Your caller raises something else, which is that our stakes in this conflict and those of South Korea, while they overlap substantially, are not identical. And therefore, for us to succeed in whatever path we take, we and the South Koreans need to be together. And a strategy in which we gamble South Korean lives for our own security will not be obviously supported by the South Koreans, and they'll find a way to undermine it. So the rift I was talking about earlier between us and the South Koreans
right.
is a fundamental barrier to getting to a solution with North Korea, because we can't. No strategy of ours can succeed unless we're together with the South
but
Koreans.
But just in the 10 seconds we've got here, would the United States take on that kind of threat to an ally, South Korea, in its national interest before it had exhausted every other opportunity?
In the past, we had the agreement with South Korea that we would try a diplomatic path, and that if a diplomatic path was not successful, that a military path would be pursued. And that was something that they also were prepared to agree to.
This is Ominous Talk. We're talking about the other weapons crisis tonight, North Korea and its nuclear threat. Does a hardline U.S. only make North Korea more dangerous? Is the Bush Doctrine of Preemption helping or hurting chances of a resolution here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the other weapons crisis, North Korea and its nuclear threat. You can join the conversation. Is the Bush Doctrine of Preemption helping or hurting chances of a resolution here? And is surrender the only way off the axis of evil? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight from Chevy Chase, Maryland, by Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington and a frequent visitor to North Korea. And with me in the studio tonight, Ashton Carter, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration and now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can join us as well. Tim is calling from Boston. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just wanted to say that I do think the policy of preemption is really the only policy that we can go in these days, because given the nuclear, biological, I mean, these guys, the North Koreans have, through the last 50 years, shown strange behavior. They kidnap Japanese and bring them back and hold them for 30 years. The only reason why they are still there is that they threaten the city of Seoul with utter destruction in a matter of minutes.
And are you willing to go to preemption if all those lives in Seoul are on the line, Tim?
It's what the fellow said earlier is true. It's the calculus of international politics these days. I mean, I certainly would do
everything I could. I take that as a yes.
But I would do everything I could to protect the people in Seoul. But if it wasn't them going, it would be somebody else. And these guys are not. They've shown that they cannot adhere to an agreement. They will produce nuclear weapons for export. We may be the number one target in the world, but we aren't the only target in the world. Mm. And they cannot be allowed to produce nuclear weapons that have no control on them.
We've got it. Selig Harrison, weigh in with us here on how preemption and this doctrine is figuring into this conversation. I mean, no one describes this as a first choice, but does such a stated doctrine end up waiting whatever negotiations or talks or non-talks there are away from a peaceful outcome?
Absolutely. I mean, we're just defeating our objective. Our objective is to prevent North Korea, is to get North Korea to agree not to develop nuclear weapons, not to reprocess fissile material that could be transferred to terrorists. Those are our interests. And we're not pursuing them intelligently because the policy of preemption, the lesson that people were saying after the Iraq War, I hope that the other countries have gotten the right lessons from this war. Well, the lesson they've gotten is that they need nuclear weapons to deter us from making happen in North Korea what happened in Iraq. Mm. And so, you know, it's just working completely counter to our objectives and bringing about a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. One of the callers was talking about as if North Korea is out to nuke Los Angeles or something, and that therefore we might as well have preemption now and get it all over with. You know, that's a complete misunderstanding of what's going on. They are considering the nuclear route, and they're right on the brink of it because they want to deter us, not because they want to attack us. They know that if they so much as attack even a U.S. base in Japan as part of a war, that would give us the pretext for going in and ending North Korea. So they're not about to use nuclear weapons against us unless we get into a completely confrontational relationship in which we continue to pursue regime change, and then they consider us completely, hopelessly hostile.
So, Ash Carter, how's the balance look here in this administration right now? You said we need both an openness to negotiation and a military threat on or near the table. Do we have the right balance as we face North Korea today?
No, I don't think we have the right balance now. I don't think that Jim Kelly is going into these talks able to describe a settled view of the United States.
Well, why the heck not? The stakes are very large. Well, how can he responsibly be over there without being able to address the problem?
The administration, I'm not trying to excuse the administration. I think it's to me inexcusable that 2 years into an administration, one doesn't have a strategy towards North Korea. But the fact of the matter is that clearly they have not battled internally, and they haven't settled the fundamental issue which Sig Harrison rightly keeps raising, which is, are you prepared to live with North Korea if it gets rid of its nuclear weapons? Or is there still something wrong with North Korea?
But is it worth, you said earlier, are we prepared to live with this odd little thing, North Korea? Is, absent the nukes, is there something so intolerable about North Korea, as bizarre a little country as it may be, that the fate of South Korea, of Japan, of maybe the United States and others would be put on the line to get rid of it? That sounds like ideology trumping everything else.
I quite agree, and I think that I too would like the North Korean people to have a better government. But I'm not prepared to run the risks that we've been discussing here in order to give them one by force. Nuclear weapons is another matter. Mm-hmm. That's so serious that we are willing to run these kinds of risks, or at least to consider running these kinds of risks. But liberating 22 million North Korean citizens, which is surely a worthy thing to do, by a war of the horrific scale that a Korean War, I think, would be irresponsible.
So why not just guarantee them their sovereignty and say, you give us the nukes, you've got your sovereignty, and look for ways that don't put so many lives at risk to put pressure on North Korea. I want to turn to another call. June's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, June. You're on the air.
Thanks. I guess I'm really concerned. I don't know all that much about the issues, but it seems to me that as a nation, we're really very young. We're barely over 200 years old, and I think we have to really, truly learn the art of diplomacy. I also think that we don't have a mindset that has completely wrapped itself around an oriental matter of diplomacy. I think that we're like the adolescent boy who thinks that they are invincible, and because we've got these tools, we can come in and we can say we have the might, and therefore we're right.
June, would you guarantee the regime in Pyongyang, in North Korea, that they could go on and we would guarantee their sovereignty if they would put the nuclear weapons down? Would you leave North Koreans under that system in order to have the nuclear weapons taken out of the equation?
I think I heard someone say a long time ago that once we as humans wrapped our minds around the possibility of using nuclear weapons, we entered an entirely new violent world. And, you know, I was even concerned in Iraq that there might be someone who said, you know, I bet we could do a tiny nuclear war, a little nuclear baby bomb someplace, and that would do this. I think it just has unleashed some truly dangerous activity. And I think, you know, the gentleman, Mr. Harrison, was saying the so many ways that we have lost opportunities to truly be diplomatic is important.
June, thanks very much for your call. Al is calling from Boston. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Yeah, very quickly. I'm a Korean War veteran, and I recall very clearly what history taught us. We wiped out the North Korean army, and we had a war with China. And that's exactly what we're looking at if we do anything with North Korea, is that we're going to end up in a conflict with China.
Well, China's changed some since then, but clearly there would be knock-on effects. Let's look at what they might be today. Al, thanks for your call. Ash Carter, if it should, God forbid, come to this kind of scenario, how do you imagine the neighbors, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, responding?
They'll all be appalled if it comes to war and if they judge that the United States didn't go the full diplomatic length to try to reach a diplomatic settlement, they will be appalled. However, the Chinese have indicated for some years now that they're not prepared to go to war with the United States over North Korea. Remember, for the Chinese too, like for us, a nuclear North Korea is a disaster. For exactly the same reasons we talked about at the top of the hour, why nuclear weapons is a problem for us. What they don't want is a collapse of North Korea on their border. That's 22 million people. That's like a big Mariel boat lift right into China from North Korea. So they're trying to balance which is worse, the collapse of North Korea through war or a nuclear North Korea. And they're both terrible options for China.
Selig Harrison, our time is winding down, but if you were at the table, what's the bill of particulars you'd write up at hand to the North Korean across that table in Beijing to try and bring us to the quickest, least bloody resolution?
I would say that Secretary Powell is prepared to make a joint statement with the foreign minister of North Korea. It would be a signed statement, not a treaty, but a signed declaration that the United States respects the sovereignty of North Korea, will not hinder its economic development, which is a code word for opening up the World Bank and other international aid institutions to them, and most important, that we would work with them to negotiate a mutual non-attack pledge linked to the denuclearization of North Korea, that during the period of negotiations they would now open up, that pledge would be operative. We would pledge not to use nuclear or other weapons against them during negotiations. And if we succeed in getting their nuclear weapons program dismantled, that pledge would become operative for good. I think they would buy that, particularly if we gave them a little food aid and energy aid at the same time.
On the side, Ash Carter, just in the few seconds we have left, can you imagine this administration offering that to North Korea?
Not until there's an internal battle that is settled along the lines that Selig Harrison indicates.
This is the unending Powell-Rumsfeld battle, you might say.
Until the president pronounces on this matter. And by the way, I'm not sure North Korea would accept that deal anymore. I certainly hope they would. They may have crossed the Rubicon and decided that the only way to protect themselves is with nuclear weapons.
And with that, we're out of time. Ashton Carter, I want to thank you so much for coming in tonight.
My pleasure.
Ash Carter is former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. He's currently Professor of Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a longtime Korea watcher. And Salig Harrison, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Salig Harrison is Director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington. He's author of Korean Endgame. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a former U.S. ambassador to three Middle Eastern countries discusses the challenges in creating a new government in Iraq. This is On Point. Few Americans have had as much experience working in the Middle East as Herman Iltz. As a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Libya, Iltz witnessed many of the events that have defined modern Mideast politics during his 30-year career in the Foreign Service. He also served in Iran and Iraq and played a seminal role in the creation of the Camp David Accords in 1978. Speaking yesterday at the Federal Reserve Building in Boston, Iltz was pessimistic about the challenges facing the U.S. in creating a new government in Iraq. Here is an excerpt from his speech.
Iraq is a somewhat lawless place. When we speak of instilling democracy, it seems to me that what is necessary for any democracy to work effectively is a sense of self-discipline on the part of the public, the individual members of the public. To me, a missing element, and I don't mean to say this critically, is the sense of discipline that existed, for example, in Japan and that existed in Germany after the World War II period. Iraq is not a very disciplined place. Indeed, one of the reasons for the recurrent instability in Iraq since the state's founding some 70 years ago is this very sense of lack of discipline that exists in the public. It's worth bearing in mind that long before Saddam Hussein, Iraq has a history of military interventions. In 1936, there was a military revolt on the part of a colonel in the Iraqi army, which was a rather bloody affair for a time. In 1941, there was another one against the British at that particular time. In 1958, the monarchy was overthrown in a rather bloody affair. And in 1963, there was another military revolt, in part at least, and I don't for a moment discount the personal ambitions of the military officers involved, but in part this was a reaction on the part of the military to the lawlessness and the corruption that it perceived existed on the Iraqi scene. One likes to hope that some of this may have changed over the years. But one has to be honest and recognize that there is no reason to believe that this sense of lawlessness, in a positive sense, some would call it this sense of individualism, at least at a political level, and corruption has changed. As I said at the beginning, Iraq, in the best of circumstances, is a difficult place to govern.
Herman Iltz, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia and Egypt, speaking yesterday at the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this